that they would never have a citizen army again. They got rid of the draft. I mean, there were just tens of thousands of young men in this country in the 1960s and early 70s.
And they certainly got rid of the journalism.
Yeah, but they had a direct experience of what we were doing to this poor peasant nation in Southeast Asia that wanted to have national independence and a social revolution. And they came back jaded and rebellious, and they fragged their troops, they fragged their officers, they rebelled, and they made all kinds of connection between inequality at home and empire abroad. And so they got rid of that. They got rid of a citizen army. And now we just send a certain select number of people recruited from the working class mainly to go serve multiple tours in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and God knows where. And that loss of direct experience, I think, is a big part of the loss of a tangible sense of empire.
We're at the bottom of the hour. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This is Press Watch, and I'm speaking with Paul Street, who has been writing for Counterpunch and other publications. And we are talking about Beyond Authentic Opposition, an article which you can find in Counterpunch and related issues. And on imperialism, I don't know where to start. And I certainly have to agree with your analysis that a great deal of the way we experience it now comes out of the rejiggering of the American psyche after the Vietnam War. I remember that the initial Bush administration was very much concerned with that. I remember the Reagan administration attacking that tiny island. What the hell was the name of that island? Grenada.
Apparently,
it was attacked for the sake of propaganda. It was attacked for the sake of making Americans feel good after a truck bomb. Just bizarre when you look at it in detail. And I find that it is very hard to engage Americans on the immoral nature, the unacceptable nature of imperialism. And as you say, we don't even use that word. And so how can I go from there to say, well, how can it be right to invade a country on false pretexts like we did with Iraq and Afghanistan? These were false pretexts. This is an illegitimate war. And drop bombs on wedding parties and funerals and blast people apart and have over and over again this scene where family members are running around trying to find the pieces of their child, just sort of automatically reacting to a bizarre and unacceptable situation by trying to piece their children together. Over and over and over we've done this. And it's like, then ask, why do they hate us?
Sure, and I'll never forget, at some point, I can't remember when he was president yet, or if he was about to become president, and Trump was talking about this travel ban, this Muslim travel ban, which now has been sort of partially upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, and he said, well, we've got to sort of put a hold on this until we can get a handle, to some extent, on why they hate us over there. And nobody outside the marginalized left in this country, rose up in sort of nauseated outrage against the absurdity of that statement. But that anybody who's actually looked seriously at U.S. policy in the Middle East and in the Muslim world knows that there's just absolutely no mystery about that. I mean, some estimates of the premature deaths unnecessarily caused by the thoroughly criminal and illegal false pretext invasion of Iraq. Some of the estimates go over as high as 1 million and even over 1 million. And, I will never forget when progressives were getting all excited about Barack Obama already in 2005 and 2006, and I was in Chicago at the time, and he goes to the Chicago Council of Global Affairs and gets up and says incorrectly and deceptively that most Americans actually supported the U.S. invasion of Iraq. It's not true that they didn't. But my bigger point is that he said later in the speech, they support it because, he said, they've seen their sons and daughters. This is Barack Obama, the supposed peace candidate in 2006. He said, they've seen their sons and daughters murdered in the streets of Fallujah. And, Fallujah was just an incredible reference for him to make, sort of in support of this idea that, of course, we support the invasion of Iraq. False, but that of course we support the invasion of Iraq because our troops have been murdered there. Fallujah is a town that we blasted to smithereens twice in 2004, once in April and again in November of 2004. We used radioactive ordnance. We used white phosphorus. We waged chemical warfare, creating an epidemic of childhood leukemia in and around Fallujah that is still with them today. The death count ran into the tens of thousands. It amounted to basically the leveling of a major Iraqi city, all as punishment inflicted by the U.S. Marines for the outrageous sin of them having killed four Blackwater mercenaries earlier that year who were part of an illegal and criminal petro-capitalist invasion of their country. So, you know, I mean, the Democrats participate in this kind of myth-making that we're the victim and we're the good guy every bit as much as the Republicans do. When one of Obama's first military actions in his first year when he was in office, after he got his Nobel Peace Prize, was to order the bombing of a village in western Afghanistan's Farah province called Bola Baluch, where dozens of children were blown to pieces. Their body parts were carried in wheelbarrows up to the town village, parents in tears. And Obama refused to ever issue so much as even an apology for this egregious action, which is just a typical U.S. action under Obama, you know, a so-called collateral damage incident in which dozens of children are killed, though at one point Hillary Clinton, then his Secretary of State, was moved to issue a statement of American regret for the unfortunate action.
The whoops, and now the beast is just dripping drool with its eyes on North Korea, and Americans are being encouraged to think of North Korea as a danger and a morally bankrupt state and just all the list of things that go with warmongering. And there's two, as I was mentioning in the headlines, there are two aircraft carrier groups off the coast, the USS Ronald Reagan and the USS Nimitz. Situation is looking worse by the day with the UN ambassador talking war. And we're supposed to not just accept this, but just be enthusiastic about it. It's like there are people who just cannot wait to start the blood flowing.
And this seems almost just sort of made to wag the dog order. I've just been sort of waiting for this. Every day that the media news cycle is focused on Trump's campaign against the hideous North Korean regime, you know, is a day in the news cycle that is not discussing the fact that he has historically low popularity ratings, that is not discussing the fact that the Republicans are trying to kick 24 million people off of health care and trying to pass regressive tax cuts, which is just absurd in a nation where the top tenth of the top 1% already owns more wealth than the bottom of the 90%. Than the bottom 90%. So, you know, every day that they do that is taking focus off of that. Nobody has any history of Korea at all in this country. They know nothing about it. I doubt most Americans could even locate Korea on a blind, you know, global map, on a global map that didn't have national names on it. And they know nothing about the pillaging of Korea, and particularly North Korea, and the saturation bombing of it, and the bombing of its dikes, and you know, during the Korean War in the 1950s. And, you know, I mean, you could just go on. Nobody knows anything about it, but they do know that this guy, you know, that the dear leader is kind of a lunatic, and that, you know, they know that nuclear missiles are dangerous. What nobody knows is that they would stand down in a second from this nuclear sort of, banging their nuclear cage a little bit, if they were allowed to receive significant economic assistance.
And the Chinese have been very clear that they're willing to stand down just on the basis of the U.S. withdrawing its biannual multi-billion-dollar war games.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and the other thing no one, I think, probably knows in this country is that there's a rationality to their nuclear deterrent. It has been a part of American strategic doctrine forever that there needs to be regime change in Pyongyang and in North Korea. And if they didn't have that deterrent, they would have been that regime would have been taken down completely and reintegrated into the world capitalist system. You know, and nobody knows this, so it's very frustrating.
I saw an article in the, I can't remember which part of the corporate press, that was saying that the North Koreans, and the tone is that, oh, what fools they are sitting on top of trillions of dollars worth of metal ores and other resources and don't have the economic strength to extract it. You know, the implication, of course, being in the context that, you know, gosh, the U.S. Corporations could do so much a better job. And that's where I think that's where you really see the motivations for this sort of thing, that some billionaire somewhere is being tartly refused an additional billion by this person that he doesn't even know or care about.
Right. Well, plus it's a missed opportunity to escalate the climate cooking of the planet through the over-extraction of natural resources. Maybe we could get to 500 carbon parts per million by 2040 instead of the current trajectory of 2050, if we could just get in there and take care of some of those resources. Yeah.
By all means,
and,
let's talk about
people
that.
People just don't have that history, and we're supposed to hate people that we know nothing about. I'm always struck by how we're supposed to hate Iran. I mean, and the irony being that Iran is sort of the closest thing to a democratic society with social liberty and women's rights. I mean, I don't want to go crazy here, but it's the closest thing to a modern sort of democratic westernized society in the Middle East. And yet, Americans have been conditioned by propaganda ever since 1979 to hate that country above all in the Middle East, and it's right across a gulf from the most reactionary state on earth, where they behead people for adultery and for being gay, or even just for dissenting. I'm talking about Saudi Arabia. And that's our buddy. We just cut a $110 billion arms deal with them, but we're supposed to hate Iran. It's just astonishing.
It's as you mentioned in your in another piece that you published, we need a first American revolution. And when I put it all together, I mean, if we really look at what we're living in, so much of the population, simply by dint of not having a light-colored skin, cannot walk down the street without fearing being shot to death by our police. We, all poor people and all people of color, must fear our police. And we can't say that this is a police state. We see, I see articles saying, oh, we risk a police state. I mean, how much more do we have to risk? Obviously, we are in, I mean, with just the numbers of incarceration, we are in a police state that is fueled by racial animosity and by the need to keep the white population on top and in competition with the rest of the population. And how can this nation, I would like to ask, if I could ask anyone particularly, or if I could ask a group, how can this nation take the attitude that it is morally superior when the numbers show that we have far more people in jail, on parole, et cetera, than North Korea or Iran, and proportionately as well?
Yeah. It really is an extraordinary accomplishment for the self-proclaimed homeland of liberty and freedom to have the highest incarceration rate of any society, historically, past, or present in the world. It is simply astonishing. And I would add that there's not only the real-time imprisonment of felons, but the lifelong branding that comes with a felony record, which makes employment and college loan applications and access to housing and just a whole panoply of things extremely difficult. And one in three black male adults right now is saddled with the lifelong branding of a felony record. It really is quite extraordinary, and it's a phenomena of the neoliberal era. It's really the U.S. incarceration rate was sort of in line with the rest of the Western world until about the 1970s, and it's one of the great ironies of our time that there's all this sort of libertarian free market rhetoric has taken over the country over the last four decades at the same time that it has been creating a gigantic police and mass incarceration state, which it's very important to point out has a strong color to it, which is highly racialized. And it's sort of one of many ways in which I like to point out that they've never really torn down the state. They've never really taken down the government. What they really want to starve is the left hand of the state, any part of government that served poor people, working class people, social equality, the environment, the common good. That's what needs to be starved. That's what needs to be destroyed. But the right hand of the state, the part of the government that distributes wealth upwards and punishes the poor, that's been expanding over the last 40 years. And I think there's an intimate relationship between those two. The more you starve the left hand of the state, the part of that sort of integrates and pacifies and brings people in and includes people in the society, the more you starve that, the more you feed the repressive, right-handed, the violent part of the state. And I think that's what we've been experiencing in the last four so-called free market anti-government years. Decades.
Well, I just got a listener question, and so I'll just pass it on to you as you are to some extent a historian. What happened to the peace movement after the Iraqi invasion?
What I witnessed was that Obama happened to it. I mean, I don't want to exaggerate that too much, because once the sort of second surge came in and Bush was successful in basically creating a Sunni Shia sectarian civil war within Iraq, and once that sort of in many ways became the main sort of focal point of violence in Iraq, all in the context of the U.S. invasion, of course, I noticed that the anti-war movement started to lose its steam. But already by 06, and certainly by 07 and 08, and I was out of Chicago in Iowa, and Iowa was kind of this ground zero for presidential politics. I was in Iowa by 07 and 08. What I really witnessed here in a campus town that used to have an anti-war movement was that everyone started sort of getting focused again, like we do every at the end of every four-year election cycle, on the hope and change that we're going to have with the presidential election. And we had a very smart and very slick and very deceptive and actually very imperial and neoliberal presidential candidate, with the added benefit of being technically black, which a lot of white people and lefties and progressives decided to think was sort of made him inherently progressive. Named Barack Obama, and he was very smart at posing as an anti-war candidate. And he was very strategic about that. And he had some help from anti-war activists in Chicago in creating this false image of himself as anti-war. And what I saw here and what I heard from other comrades in campus towns and in liberal areas was that sort of just took things over. And we're going to get Obama in there. I will never forget the very night, the very eve of the Iowa caucus in 2008, that the Obama campaign went around and slipped in the screen doors of every registered Democrat here in Iowa City a copy of the speech that he gave in Chicago in 2002 against the Iraq War, just to remind everybody that this really was your anti-war candidate. And of course, he was no such thing. He was no such thing at all. And I just related the speech he gave to the Chicago Council on Global Affairs in 06. I mean, anyone who paid real attention to Obama's foreign policy statements in elite venues, which are very different to Obama's statements when he was talking in a campus town to a bunch of anti-war people, knows that he was nothing even remotely like an anti-war candidate. But he posed as one, and all the kids around here, anti-war activist kids, went up to Minneapolis-St. Paul to protest the John McCain convention. I said, "You're going to the wrong one. You need to." Then the next president is Barack Obama, and his convention is in Denver, and that's the one you probably ought to shut down, because that guy is going to launch a drone war campaign and a reign of terror across the Middle East like nobody's ever seen. It's going to be without a lot of troops on the ground, but it's going to be from the sky. And I was born out. They went up to Minneapolis, St. Paul, got in a bunch of trouble with the police up there, and meanwhile Obama was coronated over in Denver at a convention where they wouldn't even let Jimmy Carter speak. An ex-president was not allowed to speak because he's considered to be too close to the Palestinians.
Wouldn't let an ex-president speak. I don't know. Sometimes I just don't know where to start. You put me in mind of the relationship of Bernie Sanders to the Democratic Party. And I suppose you heard Chris Hedges' speech, which took down Sanders' capitulation. I was there at the Socialist Convergence in Philadelphia when he let loose with that. And there were gasps in the audience because there were a lot of still enthusiastic and many quite crestfallen Sanders delegates there at the Socialist Convergence. The place was absolutely packed to the rafters, and it was a big, big place.
Yeah.
And we were really suffering from the heat, but we wanted to hear something. We wanted to hear about socialism. And so I'd like to ask you to comment. I mean, we're talking about the Democratic Party. We're talking about false hope. What's the relationship of Bernie Sanders to the Democratic Party?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, 50, you want to be hopeful about something. 51% of 18 to 29-year-olds in this country right now think that capitalism sucks. They didn't actually say sucks, but they do not approve, do not think it's the way to go. I mean, that's incredible. That is an extraordinary development. And I love
for people our age particularly, it's extraordinary because we were trained to just absolutely jump at the word.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're not dumb. I mean, also 50% of them say that the American dream is dead. And, I mean, they're not stupid. They see what capitalism's got on the table for them. You know, bad-paying jobs, even with college degrees, endless student debt, and the ruination of livable ecology because of the endless extraction of natural resources. I mean, they're not stupid, and I love those kids. And I went to the Iowa caucus here and was very struck by the difference between the Hillary people, the establishment, richer, white-haired, like de facto Republican Democrats from one of the rich precincts out here. And then I went over and looked at the 17th precinct, which was college kids and young adults. I mean, it was like a new left. It was like a Grateful Dead concert. It was just beautiful, you know. And they were all the Bernie people. And I've always loved those kids. My problem was always with Bernie. He really never was an independent. He was posing as an independent, and this goes back historically. He lost a congressional race in Vermont in 1988. He ran as an independent, and he split the vote with a Democrat, and they lost, and a Republican got in. This was back at this many years ago, 1988, and he cut a deal from that point on with the Vermont Democrats. They would let him run as a nominal independent. Meanwhile, he was sort of opposed to any real meaningful third-party development within the state. He got into Congress. Later, he ended up in the Senate. And the whole time he's been in there, he's been a de facto Democrat. He's voted with the Democrats practically all the time. He basically the Democrats allowed him to be a de facto party member in terms of seniority for key congressional committees. He was a friend of Bill, a supporter of the neoliberal Bill Clinton in 1992 and 1996. He was a big military budget guy, got behind the bombing of Serbia, supported outraged anti-war activists in Burlington, Vermont. I saw Bernie come out to Iowa City when he was thinking of running as a president, as a Democratic presidential candidate in late 2014, and he gave this kind of interesting speech to this packed audience at the local independent bookstore, and it was so focused on the Republicans, okay, that a junior professor had to stand up and say, "Oh, Bernie, there are corporate Democrats too. You know, did you forget that?" Still, and he honored his promise. He honored his promise. I don't know why Socialist Alternative thought he wouldn't. He honored his promise to sheepdog, which he made from the beginning, that he would sheepdog and try and send his voters into the Hillary Clinton campaign. Now, that said, there's a generational divide within the Democratic Party, and there's a bunch of younger Democrats right now who think they have to go either in a real democratic socialist direction with the party or opt for a third-party alternative now, and that's kind of exciting and kind of neat, and I think where those younger Bernie folks are is very exciting.
I should hope that there are people who realize that, especially with the climate catastrophe and the current state of the police state in the United States and in view of imperialism and the collapse of the economic distribution, that gradualism just isn't going to cut it. The time for gradualism is past. And when I think about Sanders, aside from what you said about Sanders' inadequacy, which was absolutely correct, I think, I do very much remember, I mean, the funny thing is he's so much more trustable than the other candidates, which, you know, I suppose is damning with faint praise, but I remember the fear and loathing that his nominal embrace of socialism caused in Philadelphia last year, and I had a good laugh at how hard the corporate media tried to avoid addressing the S word until it started trending on Google. You can find that on Google Trends about February of 2016, and the class divide in the streets of Philly was just palpable. But it's as you said, why did they believe that he would do other than what he said? I mean, if there's one thing he was good for, it was he followed through on what he said he was going to do, and of course he capitulated. And they really did. People really were hugging each other and crying. And I was just like, oh, my God. I was shocked.
Well, you know, the best thing Bernie said in one of the presidential debates, I remember, he was the question came across, what's the greatest threat to national security? And he didn't say Iran, and he didn't say Russia or China or any of that. He said climate change, global climate change. That's the best thing I think Bernie did in that campaign. And I think that is going to hang over us and become the existential issue that's going to dominate things over the next three decades. I mean, we literally are now at the current state of petro-capitalist, carbon capitalism. We are on pace for 500 parts per million by 2050. The technology exists to avert that. The methodologies exist to avert that. But we are on that pace right now. And, you know, Mother Earth, this is not, you do not negotiate with the laws of physics. You do not negotiate with the atmosphere. And you cannot negotiate on a climate issue and be incremental, like you can be on other issues, like healthcare, or taxation. You know, you can have a partial victory on taxation or healthcare and then come back and revisit it 5 years later or 6 years later. The environment's not like that. The ecological issue is not like there are no letter grades here. This is a pass-fail. This is a kind of leap, you know, either leap or don't go at all. It's not about trying to get 5 yards down the road. And we're coming to a kind of existential moment, I think, on the environmental issue. My distinct sense is that you cannot actually address that issue meaningfully under the profit system, and that socialism is becoming sort of an existential survival phenomena. So I'm very much an eco-socialist. I think that is something that a lot of young people know now. They know it in their bones. I mean, think about it. If you have a kid next year, they'll be 32 in 2050. 500 parts per million is the Antarctic, by all indications. It's the Antarctic. And you lose the Antarctic, and you can kiss. That's game over for the planet. And we have two decades, maybe three, to avert that, to cut carbon emissions by, I don't know, 50-60%, to reforest the planet, to convert completely over to wind, water, solar, which is technologically doable now. We know how to do it. The problem is political. I think it can be addressed. I'm skeptical. I'm technically agnostic, but I'm skeptical about whether that transition could ever happen under capitalism. And I think we're going to get that. I think we know that. I think at some point I stay optimistic and hopeful about that. And we're going to try and keep a decent future alive.
Well, speaking with Paul Street, author of books, social policy commentator, writer for Counterpunch. Now, just out of respect, you have 7 books, and I'm not sure which one to pick. Empire and Inequality, America and the World Since 9/11. How is that book doing, and or is there another that you would like to mention?
Well, that was a very unusual book. You're supposed to write your annotated essays after you've established a career as an author. It's my first book. Was actually a bunch of collected essays that I'd done on ZNet and Black Agenda Report. Then I got very much into race because I had a job as an urban racial policy analyst in Chicago, part of the civil rights movement there. About Chicago, and if anyone's interested in racism and how it works in a metropolitan environment, racial oppression in the global metropolis is sort of based on that. And then when I came out to Iowa, I got probably excessively interested in and involved in presidential politics, and that's when I started breaking down the Obama phenomena. And so I have a couple books about Obama in there, Barack Obama and the Future of American Politics, and then also The Empire's New Clothes, Barack Obama and the Real World of Power. I also did a book about the Tea Party after that called Crashing the Tea Party, along with a left political scientist named Tony DiMaggio. But the best book, if one was to pick one book that I've done, it's called They Rule, The 1% Versus Democracy, which is a book I'd always wanted to write and was afraid that I was never going to write because I was getting too caught up in the day-to-day.
That music means I am out of time.
Yeah.
So the book is They Rule, The 1% Versus Democracy. Thank you, Paul.
I really appreciate
you coming on. You're listening to KBOO Portland, and we're going out to you via KBOO 90.7 FM to all the ships at sea.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland here, and coming up on your Thursday morning, we've got Between the Covers at 11. Before that, it'll be Flashpoints at 10:15. And then at 11:30, join us for Black Book Talk, a show that features interviews and discussions of works by African-American authors. But up next, it's Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. Chris Andre is up next.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.